Heichel Menachem presents A Tale of Two Souls, an ongoing lecture series on the Tanya by Rabbi Yosef Yitzchok Jacobson. This is tape number 57 in the series, entitled A Tale of Two Unities, recorded live at Heichel Menachem, Brooklyn, New York, on the 29th of Tavis, 5759.
We're at the Daf Chavava Med Aleph, at the line beginning with the word Pivyus Baruch HaMalubash Behem, at the word Olomashal. In the previous lines, if you look back, the Alter Rebbe said what? That the Hishavus, the existence, and the bringing into being and the continuous existence of all the worlds, that they should not revert to a state of Ayin Ve'Ephes as they were, as nothingness as they were. And we know what means nothingness, absolute nothingness, which means there is no relationship whatsoever between the something that came from the nothing and the nothing, because if there would be any relationship, it wouldn't be nothing. So what is the cause of the continuous existence, as well as the initial creation of the universe? So the Alter Rebbe concluded with the words, Einei Ela Dvar Hashem V'ruach Pivyus Baruch HaMalu Rebbe. It's nothing. Einei Ela. This is not metaphoric language. Einei Ela. It's nothing save the Dvar Hashem, the utterance of Hashem V'ruach Pivyus Baruch, and the breath of His mouth, so to speak, HaMalu Bishbahem, which is manifested in them, which is enclosed in them, in them, in all the worlds, the upper world, the lower worlds. It's not only the physical world, even the spiritual worlds. And the spiritual worlds, in a way, is a bigger chiddush than when we talk about the physical worlds. He says, "Ha'ilam esalyein vitachtein," because the physical world, you'll say, physical world, you'll say, "Is yesh meyayin." No, obviously, there's no physical properties in Hashem's existence. But what about the spiritual worlds? Aren't they an evolution and a development from Hashem's identity? No. Because Hashem is identity-less and personality-less and character-less in the positive sense of the word. This is a personality-less being who is below personality, and then this being beyond personality. So even the greatest supernal, extraordinary spiritual worlds are defined by some type of identity and some type of character. And any type of identity and character is yesh me'ayin, is something from nothing. So therefore, the Alter Rebbe says, Einu, its whole existence is El Advar Hashem. It has no independent reality or realness of its own, but the Dvar Hashem, which is constantly bringing it into being. And now he continues. Well, the Mashal. And once we establish this point, that the world has no independent reality, but what? But the Dvar Hashem, the utterance of Hashem, which is constantly bringing it into being. Let's now analyze the nature of our whole universe, which is defined exclusively by the Dvar Hashem. Well, a mashal to illustrate from the speech of a human being. K'may b'nefesh adam. From the soul of a human being, when a man utters a single word, which this single word is kiloi mamish, is absolutely as if nothing. It's as absolutely nothing. Afilu legabe klolus nafshe hamedabers. Even when compared only to his articulate soul, shehu pchinas levush hamtzayishal. And when we talk about the nefesh hamedabers, the soul as a speaking reality, this is the soul's middle garment, shokayach hadibur shalom, namely its faculty of speech. The soul, as mentioned in chapter 4 at length, has three garments. It has 10 faculties and three garments. The 10 faculties constitute her inner personality, three intellectual faculties and 7 emotional and functional faculties. In addition to that, the soul has three garments, three instruments of expression through which it expresses her personality, namely, machshava, thought, dibur, speech, maisa, action, dibur being the levush ha'emtzai, the middle garment, so to speak. So even when you compare the one word that a human being uttered to his overall power and ability of speech, his kayach ha'dibur, the middle garment of the soul, this one word is kalay mamish. It has absolutely no value and significance because sheyachar ledaber diburim le'en katz v'tachlos. Because this faculty can produce an infinite number of words. And next to infinity, one word has no value whatever. The kol shekein. Surely this is true when you compare the one dibur even to the general overall power of speech existing in the soul, to the nefesh hamedaberes. The kol shekein is surely then, when you compare this word to the soul's innermost garment, which is the faculty of thought, which is the source of the speech, and she thought is the life force of man's speaking ability and man's words. So when you compare this word to this soul's innermost garment, which is, so to speak, much more closer and more expressive of the soul, this one word has certainly no value and significance, even more than the valuelessness of this one word relative to the kayach hadibur. The ein tzarich loimar, it goes without saying, that this word is as naught and nothing when compared with the essence and very identity of the soul, not just when you compare it to the power of speech, and certainly to the power of thought. But it goes without saying, when you compare this one word to the essence and very entity of the soul, shehein esher b'chinoisa hanal, these being its 10 attributes and faculties mentioned above, refers it to chapter 3 with Alter Rebbe, discusses the 10 koiches hanefesh, chachma bina das chesed gvura tiferes netzach hayisayd malchus. Conception, comprehension, application, attraction, rejection, integration, victory, submission, bonding, and sovereignty. So when we compare these one word to the very essence and identity of the soul, certainly it has no value and significance whatsoever. Which from them are derived the letters of thought, that are clothed in one speech when it is uttered. So the ultimate source of the letters of speech, which come from the letters of thought, ultimately are produced from the very personality of the human being, his intellectual, emotional personality. So when we compare this one word to the muhus ha-nefesh, it certainly has no value, even more than the valuelessness when we compare it to the thought process. And he explains, ki ha-machshava hi gam kin b'chines eishis kamei hadib. Because ultimately, thought too, just like speech, consists of letters. except that the letters of thought are more spiritual and more refined. But ultimately, they both share a common characteristic that are defined by letters. We communicate our speech, our words through letters, and our thought process also is defined by letters. A human being thinks with letters. A human being thinks in a specific language, as we know. So Machshav and Dibur are both defined by letters. It's just that the letters of thought are much more subtle, are much more dak. Dak means much more subtle, refined, edel, less coarse, less tangible, much more spiritual. So therefore, Machshav is indeed superior to Dibur in the sense that it expresses the soul in a deeper way. But nevertheless, it has a very powerful common characteristic with Dibur. So therefore, you cannot compare the insignificance and the state of nothingness, so to speak, that defines one word relative to thought and speech, to the overall power of thought and speech, as the valuelessness and the insignificance of the one word when it's compared to the source of the thought and the speech, the very identity of the soul. Because thought, ultimately, is also defined by letters. Are the letters of thought actually thought, or the way the thought expresses itself? Thought means expression. That is what thought is. Hoo-hoo, very good. That's why it's a levush. Aval eser b'chinis chachma bina das chulu. This is all concerning thought and speech. But the 10 attributes, chachma bina das, the 3 intellectual faculties, and chuli, the emotional faculties. Chachma, again, conception, bina, comprehension, das, application, all the faculties which he discussed in chapter 3. Hein shoydesh u'makir ha-machshava, they are the root and the source of thought. Ve'ein behem b'chines aisyas ha-dayin. Kaidem shemislapshes b'levosh ha-machshava. And therefore, before being clothed in the garment of thought, they as yet lack the element of letters. Aisyas is something that is superimposed upon them when they have to be communicated. And in their communicative process, there are 2 elements. There is communication via the mouth, speech, and communication to yourself via the thought process. But prior to their enclosement in thought, they do not possess. There is no component of aisyas, of letters existing within them. One human being communicates through French and the other through English, Yiddish, Hebrew, Mandarin, Italian, or whatever. The same is true concerning thought. Sometimes we're unaware of it because it's much more subtle and it occurs in a swift fashion, but there's no such a thing as not thinking in a specific language. Because thinking, just like talking, is made up from words, which are made up from letters, and necessitate, obviously, languages. So everyone thinks in his or her distinct language. But everyone thinks, you'll examine the next time you're thinking, and you'll see that you're thinking in a specific language. What about love? Do we also love in various languages? Say, this person loves in French. And this person loves in English. And this person loves in Spanish, or in Hebrew, or in Yiddish. This is the element of man's soul, not the element of man's garments. And here there are no aisyas. You don't love in a specific language, because love is not made up from aisyas. Aisyas are not a part of the component of love. When you want to communicate that love, either to other people, to the person you love, or even to yourself, but you want to communicate it, then letters are introduced. But in the very love experience, no aisyas. The same is true concerning the intellectual realm of man. In Havana, in the understanding, will you say, someone explains to you an idea, this person understood the idea in French, and this person understood the idea in Russian. In the understanding of the Svara, there are no aisyas. Understanding, feelings, are like a picture that gets engraved in the identity of the soul, and the component, excuse me, and the component of Isis do not play a role in that realm. When one wants to communicate the logic, the idea, the concept, again, to someone else or even to himself, Isis must be introduced. But the essence of the Svara, the essence of the experience of Chabad, transcends the realm of letters and Isis. L'mashal, for example, K'shenefelus eizei ava v'chemde b'liber shel adam. When a man suddenly becomes conscious of a certain love or desire in his heart, before it has risen from the heart to the brain to think about it, to ponder it, when the human being experiences a certain passion, a desire, an affection, a love in his heart, before he begins analyzing, thinking about it, which means communicating it to himself, pondering on it and so forth, it has not yet acquired the element of words, the element of letters. Rak, what are we dealing with? It is only a chayfetz poshut v'chasheka b'lev, a pure desire and longing in the heart, el hadavar ahu hanechmed etzlei, for the object of his affection. V'chol shekein, all the more so, koydem shenof la'ataiva v'achem de'belibe lo'yisidavar, before he began to feel in his heart a craving and desire for that thing. When it was yet confined within the realm of his intellect, his understanding, and his knowledge, corresponding apparently to the three faculties of Chachma Bina Das. So before a human being experiences a passion to something, there has to be some intellectual experience. The brain is the central nervous system and the ultimate definer of all of our interactions and perceptions. And before the knowledge of a certain reality, its properties, which comes only through the mind, there cannot be a feeling. So certainly before the human being experienced the taiva and the chemda, it was still, so to speak, in the intellectual realm. Shahayanoi da etzloi oisei davar. Meaning that the thing, that specific thing, was known to him. What was known to him? What the thing is. Its dimensions, its aspects, its properties. Shahunech madvinayim. That it's desirable and pleasant. V'toi v'yafe. And it's something good and beautiful to attain and to cling to. He knew that that thing was nechmad noyim, and that it's good and beautiful to attain that thing as a result of it being nechmad v'noyim, good and pleasant, desirable and pleasant. Kegoin, for example, and he gives two examples. Lil ma'id eze chachma, to study a certain discipline. Eilech eleze ma'ichal arif, or to eat some delicacy. So then, in this state of the intellectual appreciation of the desirable object, before the appreciation has developed into an emotion, when it was still relegated to the intellectual realm, when the human being knew about this thing, there are certainly no letters which are an integral component of that intellectual perception. Rak, only. Only after the desire and craving have already descended into his heart, as a result of the stimuli of his wisdom, understanding, and knowledge, and only after that, when Chazrava also mehalev lemayach, she ascended once again from the heart to the mind. Lach shevul aharirba, to think and to ponder. Eich lohaitzi tavasi mikayach lapoil, how to implement his desire and take it out from a state of potentiality to a state of actuality. Lahasig hamaychul oilemidas hachachme bepoil, to actually obtain that food, or actually study that subject, when the human being understands it and then communicates it to his heart, and then his heart receives, experiences an emotion towards it. After that, that thing, so to speak, ascends from the heart to the brain, and now the human being begins thinking and pondering how to implement that desire in actuality. For example, how to go ahead and obtain that food which he experienced the longing to, or how to actually go and study that discipline, and so forth, how they become. It is only at this point that Noel Dubchinus Aisyas Bemeiche, that letters, so to speak, are born in one's mind, Shehein Aisyas Kiloshin Amva'am, corresponding to letters and the language of every single nation, who the people of every single nation employ these letters when speaking and thinking about everything in the world, and about everything in the world, each thinking in his own language. It's at this stage when the Isis of Machshavar are born in his mind, which Isis, every language has its own Isis. There are various nations. Various nations produce various languages. These nations use these letters and these languages and these sentences, which are structured from the words and the letters, to talk and to think about every single issue that exists in their life. And here is where Isis begin playing a role. Hence, at conclusion, Alter Rebbe says, what we have from this is, we understand the valuelessness and the insignificance that one word plays relative even to the power of speech, certainly relative to the power of thought. The Ein Tzarich Lomar, as he says, is not even a need to emphasize its valuelessness relative to what transcends thought and speech, to that element that transcends letters, which is the very identity and personality of the soul. Why does Alter Rebbe use these two mashalim of desiring a good piece, a delicacy, and desiring to learn a specific discipline? So you're saying that it's two extremes, Mr. Intellectual and Mr. Physical. What? He says first Chachma. That's an interesting diuk. On the bottom of the Avchavav and Aleph, you're asking, he says, again, Lilmed eze chachma, eilechel eze maichel arev. So first comes chachma, and then comes the achila taiva. When he discusses, that's in the taiva. When he discusses implementation of the taiva, he first discusses the maichel, and then the chachma. Everything else besides that is understood. You're asking, how can the Alter Rebbe say that you know something without Aisyas? How can you know something without Aisyas? You're saying in knowledge there is already Aisyas. The Alter Rebbe says that before the Taiva there is knowledge beyond Aisyas. How can there be knowledge about anything without Aisyas? No, what do you say? No. So you're saying that by a child and an animal, it's like an image reflection. Huh? Huh? Without Isis. What is Alter Rebbe saying here? What is the point? What is the point that Alter Rebbe wants to convey? He begins with analyzing the relationship between a single word to the general human personality and human structure. And he compares that one word to three elements in the human character, in the human persona. A, to the power of speech, B, to the power of thought, and C, to the general human personality, as he defines it as the 10 faculties and attributes that define us as human beings. And he begins by saying that one dibur is keloi mamish, is absolutely as if naught and nothing, and it's obviously as, because it's not nothing, a word is a word. But it says, as if it would be naught and nothing, relative even to the power of speech that the soul has. Why? Because yachel adab et burim leinketz. Because the human being has the ability to produce an infinite amount of words. The soul, the Alter Rebbe is saying, has the ability to talk infinitely. When you compare one word with this power in the human being, one word doesn't constitute even 1% of the Kayach HaDibur. That's why it's Kaloi Mamash. And this is a famous axiomatic thought that pervades Jewish philosophy in a very big way, so to speak. The Alter Rebbe himself discusses this in chapter 48 of Tanya, the relationship of the finite to the infinite versus the relationship of a smaller finite to a larger finite. And the example that's given is numbers. Again, it's an incomplete analogy, but that's the example usually given. The Alter Rebbe employs it in chapter 48 of the Tanya. An interesting example. What is the relationship between $1 and $1 million? Is $1 significant in the world of $1 million? What do you think? Huh? Absolutely insignificant? Huh? Very small significance, but it's significant. Why is it significant? For a very obvious reason. A million is a composite of 1,000,000 ones. True. Obviously. Is $10 closer to $1 million than $1? Huh? Obviously. Also, not majorly closer. The one who has $1 million will not mourn the loss of $1 and will also not mourn the loss of $10. But ultimately, 10 is a little bit closer because 10 constitutes a larger percentage of the million. And 100 moves you even closer, and 1,000 moves you even closer, and 100,000 you're getting serious. But the very fact that 100,000, you're getting more serious than 99,000 means that in two you're getting more serious than one. That's the relationship of finiteness, of finite entities and properties with each other, whether you're talking about money or dollars or beings, it's irrelevant. What about, however, when we introduce the concept of infinity into our vocabulary? Now, the concept of infinity is obviously extremely nebulous and celestial and it's quite incomprehensible, but the reason is because we have no tangible embodiment of infinity. When you talk about infinite numbers, the Chayvus HaLevavos writes this in Shar HaBchina, in the first Shar, that infinity can never be materialized, because once it's materialized, it's not infinite anymore. You'll talk about infinite numbers. If you lay down the numbers in front of you, it's not infinite. So you'll go 1,000,000,000 and 1,000,000,000 and 1,000,000,000,000 and 1,000,000,000,000, whatever it is. Ultimately, it is defined by some type of limit. So infinity we can only understand in terms of potentiality. One second. Is 1,000,000,000 closer to infinity? Assuming an infinite amount of dollars. Assuming, theoretically, hypothetically. Is 1,000,000,000 closer to infinity than $1? What do you think? Huh? No, why not? Why not?
They're both finite.
Because both of them are equally removed from the end, so to speak. The term end is really not a proper word. They're both infinitely removed from the reality we're dealing with. If you're dealing with $1 billion, 1,000,000 is removed from 1,000,000,000 significantly, but one is even more removed. When you're dealing with an infinite reality, so 1, 10, 1,000, 1,000,000,000, 1,000,000,000,000, and 1,000,000,000,000 are all mamish identical. By assuming and reaching the state of 1,000,000,000, you haven't come one iota closer to your destination. When you're dealing with something finite, the one constitutes a part of that finite reality. A tiny part, an extraordinarily tiny part, but nonetheless a part, an iota. When you're dealing with infinity, one is not a part of infinity. 1,000,000,000 is not a part of infinity. 1,000,000,000 is not a part of infinity. If it would be a part of infinity, it's not infinity. Because infinity that's made up by 1,000,000,000 and 1,000,000,000, 1,000,000,000 will never become infinite. We use the term infinity as if it's these numbers become infinite. Infinity is another type of reality. That's not made up. It's not a composite from ones and tens and hundreds and millions and that. If it would be a composite of that, it wouldn't be infinity. Infinity begins in another realm, in another scope. Zog der Alter Rebbe, that in the presence of the infinite capacity of the soul to speak, one word is valueless. It's considered as though it's non-existent. So you ask the question, how can you say one word is valueless and insignificant? Everybody knows that one word can destroy a life, and one word can build a life. But the Alter Rebbe is not discussing here a spoken word after it has left the speaker and made its impact on the outside world. Rather, when the word is still within the presence of its source, when it's still within the infinite capacity of the soul to speak. In other words, the Alter Rebbe is not discussing here the power of a word vis-a-vis other people. Obviously, in relation to the outside world, it's a whole different story. In one case, 1,000 spoken words can be totally inconsequential. And in another scenario, one word can bring salvation or destruction to millions of lives. What concerns us here is the value of a word vis-a-vis the speaker himself. What is the value of a single word within the presence of the soul of the speaker? As part and parcel of the personality of the speaker, what is its worth as such? How much energy do you expend when you utter a single word? How much of your overall speaking energy do you expend when you verbalize one word? 10%? 1%? A millionth of a percent? Zog der Alter Rebbe, virtually none of it. Compared with the infinite capacity of the soul to speak, the energy expended in uttering but one word is absolutely insignificant and inconsequential. But then the Alter Rebbe continues to stage two, traveling upwards to the universe of man's thought, the kol shekein legabei hamachshava, as he put it. How much more so when the word is compared not with one's speech capacity, but with one's thought. In the presence of my capacity to speak, the quantity of energy expended on one word is minuscule. It does not exhaust the wellspring of my speaking energy to the slightest. But the very stuff of the energy expended in my speaking a single word has significance and value even in the presence of my overall capacity to speak. Its quantity deems it virtually non-existent. But its quality, its function, is important and noteworthy. However, in the presence of man's thought, Alter Rebbe continues, the entire existence of the spoken word is uneventful. Did you ever hear somebody telling his friend, I could not sleep the entire night. All night I was tossing and turning in bed. I was thinking about the sum of money I lost in the stock market. And those thoughts just occupied my mind all night long. So his friend turns to him and tells him, tell me, pal, how many spoken words did those thoughts occupy? If you were to verbally articulate all those thoughts that you had during the whole night in bed, how many spoken words would it come out to be? It's a ridiculous question. Why? Because in the presence of the ocean of man's thought, its articulation in a verbal and spoken form is absolutely irrelevant. It may exist there, but it doesn't occupy any data, so to speak. It's nullified within the presence of its origin, of its root, of its life force, the thought itself. The fact that the thought can be verbalized through your mouth is meaningless and irrelevant to the thought experience per se. So the single word in the presence of the thought that produces the word is virtually non-existent. So in this stage, the Alter Rebbe uses the term v'kol shekein, how much more so? The nothingness that defines the state of the spoken word in the presence of thought is far deeper than the nothingness that defines the spoken word in the presence of the infinite capacity of the soul to speak. Because the reality of the spoken word has some merit, some eminence, some significance in the presence of the capacity soul for speech. For that is ultimately what constitutes its identity, the capacity to speak. But the universe of thought transcends the whole concept of speech. The whole reality of speech in its presence is meaningless. It's insignificant. It adds nothing to it. But then he continues to step three, traveling further upwards to the inner universe of man, to the world of man's inner feelings and emotions. As the Alter Rebbe puts it, "Ve'ein sarich leimar legabei atzmus mehus hanefesh." It goes without saying that a word is as naught in the presence of the soul's essential personality. Because in the realm of thought, it is the brute, tangible, and concrete reality of speech which deems it an insignificant reality in the universe of thought. But the very concept of communication, words, letters, etc., are meaningful and eventful in the realm of thought. But in the domain of emotions, the very concept of communication is a non-event. How much data does the spoken word occupy when it is in the presence of the emotion that produces the thought that then produces the word? Imagine the closest person to you in your life approaches you and shares an intimate, genuine feeling with you. The person says, "I love you deeply. Can I give you a hug?" And you respond, "Wait a minute. How do you spell the word love?" You guys are smiling. Why are you smiling? Love doesn't have a spelling. Why is the question so ridiculous? Because in the context of a genuine outpouring of love and tenderness and vulnerability, the spelling of the word is quite irrelevant, to say the least. Now this is even after it's spoken, after the word "I love you" is articulated, is verbalized. Imagine when the feeling is still in the heart of the lover. In chapter 21, the Alter Rebbe will say that even the feeling of love has a spelling, a concealed potential spelling. It contains the ability of being articulated within the compressed form of language. But that element, the spelling of love, although maybe existing in some fashion in the feeling, is totally submerged and nullified within the presence of the emotion. It's meaningless when it's still in the presence of the very emotion. Imagine the middle of a wedding. Someone takes his Polaroid camera and he snaps a picture of the groom dancing, of the chassan dancing. And the picture comes out, he approaches the groom, and in the middle of the dancing, he shows him the picture and he says, "Hey, look how beautiful your wedding is. Look how great you look and how lovely you're dancing. When I'm experiencing my wedding, I don't need a picture of my wedding." And what a picture is to a wedding, words are to a feeling. They assume significance only when the experience producing them is gone. You never saw a family in the middle of a wedding saying, "Okay, photographer, let's see the pictures." It's the middle of the wedding. A year later, they'll say, "Come, let's see the pictures." Now the pictures are very valuable because the experience is not present anymore. So a word in the presence of the original emotion it's expressing doesn't possess an identity. It's nameless. It's as though it's non-existent. It doesn't occupy even a drop of data. in the presence of the emotion itself. Chassidus explains in various places, the Alter Rebbe also in other discourses, that oisiyos, the etymology of the word oisiyos, letters, is the term used in the pasuk Asa Boiker, the morning was brought forth. Oisiyos bring information from one place to another place. They turn an image into letters and words, which allows the image to travel to distant places. Without the oisiyos, it would not be able to travel. Oisiyos are the communication tools. So in the presence of the very image, they're useless and valueless. So here, the Alter Rebbe uses the term, it goes without saying. Ve'ein sarich leimar. It goes without saying that the word is virtually naught in the presence of the emotion. He changes. He doesn't say, ve'kol shekein l'gabi mehuzvatz musa nefesh. When he switches from dibur to machshava, he says, ve'kol shekein l'gabi ha-machshava. But here, the Alter Rebbe changes his terminology. Ve'ein sarich leimar. Because the nothingness of the spoken words in the presence of the emotion transcends and is far deeper than the state of nothingness that defines the spoken word in the realm of thought. Even thought, though transcending the concept of words, is a form of communication. Thought is comprised of words as well, as discussed above. So the spoken word ultimately has some presence in the universe of thought, as minuscule as that presence may be. As infinitesimal as that presence may be, the spoken word is insignificant and inconsequential because of its particular form of communication, the form of speech, the form it takes on in communication. But the essential element of communication is not insignificant in the universe of thought, for thought itself is all about communication. In thought there are also oisiyos. Thought are also about communicating the image, not to other people, but to myself. But the third level takes us to a new category, in which the whole element of communication is virtually a non-existent. So the nothingness of words in its presence is so much more striking and more profound than the nothingness of words in the presence of machshava. This is all the parable. I know it's complicated at first glance, but if you take time to think about it, you'll be able to digest it and internalize it. But this is all the parable. Now we go over to the point of the whole parable to begin with, and that is the nature of the relationship between Hashem's spoken word, which creates the entire cosmos, and Hashem himself, the source of the word. And for this, the Alter Rebbe employed the metaphor of a human being and the relationship between his spoken word and his own self, the producer of the word. Now, here in the Tanya in chapter 20, the Tanya being written, as discussed various times in a very brief and compressed manner, the Alter Rebbe says only the parable. He doesn't conclude it. The chapter 20 ends up with culminates with a parable. He doesn't tell us the second half of the story. So to discover the second half of the story, we must look at other discourses and writings of the Alter Rebbe, where he elaborated the point, as well as many writings of the six subsequent generations of Chabad Rebbes and leaders who crystallized, developed, and explained so many of the original ideas of the Alter Rebbe, who was the founder of the Chabad school of thought. Yiddishkeit defines creation basically as Hashem's speech. And Alter Rebbe will explain this in chapter 21, just as speech. Is essentially man's communication. So creation is Hashem's form of communication. How does Bereshis put it? Parshas Bereshis, the first parsha in the whole Torah. Vayomer Elokim yihi yor, vayihi yor. Hashem said, let there be light, and there was light. Hashem said, let there be a sky, and there was a sky. Hashem said, let the earth sprout forth vegetation, and so it was.
Hashem said, let the luminaries, the sun and the moon and the stars, be hung up in the sky and so forth. The Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos, the beginning of the fifth chapter, Ba'asara ma'maris nivra ilam, the world was created through 10 utterances. Or as the psalmist, as David HaMelech puts it in Tillim, in chapter Lamed Gimel 23, Bidvar Hashem Shamayim Nasu, over Ruach Piv Kol Tzva. Through the word, the utterance of Hashem, were the heavens made, and through the breath of His mouth, all its hosts. So the world is Hashem's speech. The Gemara in Menachos Dav Chav Tes Amud Beis takes it a step further. The Gemara explains the pasuk, Ki Biyutke Hashem Tzurei Lamim, that Hashem created all of the universes through two letters. The letter Yud and the letter He. Biyud Nivra Elam Ha'pazak the Gemara, Behe Nivra Elam Ha'za. Through the Yud, Hashem created the spiritual world of Elam Ha'ba, the future world. And through the letter Hey, Hashem created Elam Ha'za, the physical world. And the Gemara even explains why this world was created through a Hey. Because a Hey has an opening on the bottom, you can fall down from the Hey. Because in this world, the rule is that Kol Ha'reitza Lotzis Yetzei. If you want to fall out, you can fall out. If you don't want to fight the fight, you don't want to battle, nobody will stop you from ruining and destroying your life. It's your choice. But even if you fall and you want to come back in, you always have that little opening on the left top side of the hay through which you can crawl back in into fulfilling your purpose in life. Now, since creation is a perpetual event, as discussed last week, so we could say, what is the world? Hashem giving a speech. It's a long speech. It's been going on now for 55,759 years. But when you look at the world, what is our universe? It's Hashem giving a speech. Zogt Alter Rebbe, that one of the reasons for the fact that the Torah employs this parable of speech in defining the act of creation is because it gives us a glimpse into the true nature of reality. And now we must bear in mind all the three stages we discussed above in the metaphor, as we employ them concerning Hashem and His relationship to His word that creates the universe. Also in three steps. Step one, the value of the one word in the presence of Hashem's capacity of speech. Step two, its value in the universe of His thought. And step three, its value in the universe of His inner self. In the first stage, we come to realize that in the presence of Hashem's infinite capacity to speak, which means in the presence of His infinite capacity to create, because by Hashem speaking means creating, as mentioned above, the energy expended in the creation of the universe is less than minuscule. The power to create is an infinite one. And through the creation of our universe, Hashem expended, so to speak, a limited amount of energy, which produced a finite world filled with finite creatures and finite beings. So in the presence of His power of creation, the energy expended in creating the world is virtually non-existent and inconsequential. You can put it in other words. By studying the world, we get to know nothing of the quality of Hashem, even as a creator. Imagine you're preparing a thesis on the oratorical skills, on the oratorical career of a world-renowned speaker who lectured for half a century, mesmerizing audiences worldwide, revolutionizing a nation through his lectures and speeches. You're writing a paper on it, a dissertation. So your supervising professor asks, "Nu, how many speeches of his did you listen to? There are thousands of them. Have you heard them all?" You say, "No, you haven't heard them all." So the professor asks you, "Have you heard 500 of them? Have you heard 100 of them?" You say, "No." So he asks you, "Have you heard 10 of them?" "No." "Have you heard one speech of his?" You say, "No." "What do you hear? What do you listen to?" So you tell your professor, "I heard 10 minutes of one of his speeches." and you're the expert on his oratory skills, on his oratory skills. The professor shouts. By studying these 10 sentences of Hashem's speech, which is the whole world, Ba'asara Ma'amaris Divra Ilam, we know nothing of Hashem even as a speaker. By studying the universe, even for 5,000 years, one cannot gain insight even into Hashem's speaking abilities. We know nothing of God's oratory skills through examining the universe. We know nothing about His creative power. Aye, what do you mean you have a magnificent, splendorous, awesome, outstanding, extraordinary world containing myriads of layers of energy and matter from the subatomic quantum level all the way till the most base, to the outer levels of our universe, the macro level? True. True.